And Non-Human Radio was made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Om Foods, serving organic, non-GMO whole foods, including wild-caught mahi-mahi, and having the largest vegan menu in downtown Chico. Om Foods serves homemade teas and lemonades and acai bowls and smoothies blended with coconut water. And you can find them at 142 Broadway, just two blocks from Chico State. They're open from Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. and on Saturday from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. with to-go and catering available. For more info, find them at iloveomfoods.com or on Facebook. And we're also made possible by Peterson Tree Care, because trees need care. John Peterson continues his family tradition of caring for Chico's amazing natural resource. Licensed, bonded, and insured with financing available, Peterson Tree Care handles residential and commercial properties and can be reached by calling 518-0924. And this is KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Non-Human Radio. Hello and welcome to show 1929, the July 17th, 2019 episode of Non-Human Radio, where we talk animal news, animal rights, and veganism every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico and streaming online at kzfr.org. What do we have coming up, Danny Toms?
On today's show, we'll be covering the fur industry's sneaky pushback against fur ban legislation in California, wildlife management gone awry in Washington State, and an interesting environmental impact study on the collapse of the Soviet economy way back in the 1990s. And we'll end the show with some celebrity news. Also, congratulations to Serbian-born plant-powered tennis star Novak Djokovic, who won the Wimbledon's men's single final for the fifth time last Sunday. Djokovic beat former champion Roger Federer in a four-hour-long match, the longest singles game final in history. He adopted a plant-based diet for health reasons several years ago and credits his animal-free diet for boosting his performance on the court. Jeannie?
Thanks, Danny. Yeah, that was a grueling match, to say the least. So congratulations to Novak Djokovic. All right, our first story is about the fur industry and the fur bans that we've been reporting on. We know that in California we have Assembly Bill 44, which is a proposed fur ban for the entire state. The Intercept, which is an investigative journalism website, posted this very interesting story. The Intercept reports that it turns out that the fur industry is relying on a small phalanx of vocal supporters who have rallied across the country to prevent a ban on fur products, often inflaming the debate with accusations of hypocrisy and racism. Many of the impassioned defenders of fur hats and mink coats, however, have received undisclosed financial support for their activism. That's activism in quotes, right? In Sacramento, a parade of opponents appeared before the State Senate Judiciary Committee panel at a pivotal hearing over California's proposed ban on fur products, AB 44. Many of the same individuals appeared at another hearing before the California Senate Natural Resources Committee last month. Matt Gray, identifying himself only as a representative of the group Cal Small Biz and Taxpayers for Improving Public Safety, chastised legislators for seeking to regulate the cannabis industry while at the same time banning fur. He considered that a double standard, he said, he found baffling. Gray, who was also one of the opponents at the hearing last month, was joined by a large group of students who also testified against the fur ban. Andrew Aguero, who identified himself as a Native American student from California State Polytechnic University, said that, quote, the worst part of this bill is that people from a privileged culture are telling people of my culture that our culture is inhumane. And yet another activist, Andrew DiGiovanna, a biology major at Citrus College, who was also at the Senate Natural Resources hearing, identified himself as an environmentalist opposing the legislation. Others, including Edwin Lombard, a public and government relations consultant, said he viewed the fur ban as an affront to the African-American community. Lombard argued that after decades of redlining and discrimination, owning a fur coat was a way of showing we could overcome these barriers.
Wow.
The bill passed the Senate Natural Resources Committee vote committee by one vote last month, which we reported on here on Nonhuman Radio. The bill also passed a more recent vote of the Senate Judicial Committee, but questions lingered about how the debate had shifted so quickly away from a discussion over the ethics of caging and skinning wild animals into a divisive argument about identity and race, right? These little sound bites that these three activists are throwing out there. Documents obtained by The Intercept show that several of the fur ban opponents received money in exchange for their testimonies.
What? They're paid protesters? Shocked.
Gray, the representative of that group, the Cal Small Business and Taxpayers for Improving Public Safety Group, received at least $7,000 from the Fur Information Council of America, the leading trade group for companies that manufacture and sell fur products, an affiliation that he did not disclose during his comments to legislators. Asked about the money, Gray said he was not required to inform lawmakers of his clients during the hearing. Documents obtained by the activist group Direct Action Everywhere, or DXE, suggest that some of the students also received financial support for their activism. A DXE volunteer posing as an AB 44 opponent contacted Andrew DiGiovanna, who is that environmentalist opposing the legislation, who provided a contract with Mobilize the Message, a Republican consulting firm. The Mobilize the Message contract listed various ways in which workers were expected to contact four key legislators in opposition to AB 44. The contract noted that you will be compensated $175 total for the program, along with additional opportunities and bonuses for top performers, quote, top performers.
I think the other guy who got $7,000 did a little better in this shenanigan here.
He must have been clearly a top performer, going, you know, out of his way to to be more of an opponent. So this would be like, I would imagine, like expected to contact four key legislators. I don't know if that just counts as like calling their office,
yeah,
sending an email, but it's like,
it's not really gas money, so
yeah. Cliff Maloney, founder of the group Mobilize the Message, did not respond to a request for comment. Imagine that. Maloney is the president of Young Americans for Liberty, a libertarian youth group. The Federal Election Commission records show that his firm provided contract work for a number of GOP political action committees, including Protect Freedom Action Committee, which worked to elect Republican congressional candidates during the midterm election cycle last year. The company is also providing assistance to the Stop AOC PAC, a fundraising apparatus used to generate money over opposition to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. So this was just like a can of worms for me. Like, how much of the protest are we seeing, yeah, not just for animal issues, is paid college students, basically?
Right.
Neither Aguero nor DiGiovanna responded to requests for comment. Both Aguero and DiGiovanna are active in libertarian politics and appeared in a photo posted on Facebook with others who testified at the June 25th hearing in opposition to AB 44, the fur ban. Aguero ran unsuccessfully for a state assembly seat as a Libertarian Party candidate in 2017. And DiGiovanna, the environmentalist, is a West Coast officer with Young Americans for Liberty, a libertarian youth group led by Maloney of the Mobilize for the Message group. The funding from fur supporters The funding from fur supporters has roiled not only the debate in California, but also New York City, which is also considering a ban on fur products. In May, busloads of opponents to the fur ban appeared at a New York City council hearing to shout down the proposal. Reverend Johnny Green, a Harlem pastor, posted on Twitter offering the chance to win a $250 American Express gift card in connection to the council hearing. The tweet was deleted after Jabari Brisport, a community activist and teacher who serves on the board of Voters for Animal Rights, called attention to it. In New York, the Fur Information Council has contracted a number of influential lobbyists to defeat the proposed ban. For instance, records show that the industry has retained the services of SKD Knickerbocker, which is a prominent Democratic lobbying firm. So fur is a bipartisan issue. Reverend Johnny Green has also made divisive comments on the legislation, saying a ban on fur is a ban on black culture, he wrote in one column, arguing that the ban fits a pattern throughout history of blacks being told what rights they can and cannot have by the white majority. Green also did not respond to a request for comment. Stuart Mitchell, who's an animal advocate and organizer with Voters for Animal Rights, told The Intercept that the ban is not an issue of race at all, going on to say, it has nothing to do with black culture or the African-American community. It's a ban on animal cruelty. And Mitchell went on to add, I'm an animal rights activist who happens to be black. The California legislation contains exemptions for indigenous tribes that use furs for religious ceremonies and allows hunters to skin animals that they catch while hunting. Assemblymember Laura Friedman made clear that the bill is tailored to suppress the industrial fur farms that raise caged animals such as bobcats, foxes, and minks. Independent investigators have found signs of fearfulness, self-mutilation, and cannibalism and other horrible things by these caged animals held in fur production houses. And finally, to conclude, at the hearing on last Tuesday in California, over 100 people arrived in Sacramento to show their support for AB 44. At one end of the hallway, a diverse group of animal rights activists, many wearing blue DXE shirts, crowded the passageway waiting to testify in support of the bill. On the other side of the hallway, into the Senate Judiciary Committee room, a group of fur lobbyists and fur retailers, along with a contingent of largely high school and college students, huddled, awaiting their turn to speak in opposition. William Duplessis, a former assembly member who now works as a contract lobbyist for the fur industry, denied knowing any of the paid protesters or activists. But one high school student who testified in opposition to AB 44 said she had been paid to appear, nodding when asked if she had been paid through Mobilize the Message. She then declined to comment, declined to comment or give her name. Several students who protested the bill said that they were instructed not to talk to the press. And that is a Intercept article from July 10th about how protesters are paid secret cash to protest the fur ban in California and apparently in New York.
Well, that was fascinating.
Yeah. So I'm just amazed that as we talked about, the fur industry in California is not huge.
Yeah.
These bans are largely supported by the public. When you put them to a proposition, they're overwhelmingly supported because fur is just not that relevant. In part, fur is not that relevant to most people's self-image or their way of life, and they are kind-hearted. I mean, these are humane bills. These are like, we do not want this type of cruel industry to thrive in California. All right. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. If you want to follow more current events and animal rights-related news, I invite you to follow the Non-Human Radio Facebook page. Over to you, Danny.
Beginning next week, a helicopter crew will capture mountain goats in Olympic National Park and the adjacent National Forest. Captured animals will be taken across Puget Sound by refrigerator truck and released into the North Cascades Mountain Range. This is up in Washington State for the geographically challenged. The operation, now in its second year, is part of an ambitious and logistically complicated project that aims to correct historical wildlife management mistakes, to eradicate mountain goats in a range where they're not welcome, and boost their numbers in another. More than 100 goats were captured last summer and moved. Between 65 and 70 animals survived the winter, estimated Rich Harris, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife biologist, leading the agency's work to translocate goats. 5 of 10 relocated kid goats survived, he said.
I like, you know, this article, this particular paragraph emphasizes the survival and de-emphasizes the the death rate, the mortality rate. Mm-hmm. Right? We're talking about 50% death for the babies,
right?
And 30% death of the adults.
Yeah, probably pretty common with any kind of statistic. This summer, helicopter crews will again use net guns and immobilizing darts to take down goats from the air, then sling them beneath the aircraft and fly them to a staging area where the animals will receive veterinary attention before further transport. A helicopter crew snatched up 115 goats last year, according to a park count. Six goats tumbled over cliffs or were killed by darts during operations. Two died during transport. Three were euthanized because of suspected disease or behavioral problems.
Which boggles the mind. Yeah. Behavioral problems. Imagine that.
Right. Being shot, airlifted, and dumped in somewhere else. Six orphaned kid goats were taken into captivity. By last summer's end, 98 goats, many outfitted with GPS tracking collars, had moved into new homes throughout the North Cascades. Once released, some goats found a spot they liked and stayed. Others roamed long distances late into fall, according to a progress report published by WDFW. A female goat released near Vesper Peak traveled about 52 miles to Caches Ridge off Interstate 90, according to the report. Some male and female goats were documented together based on GPS tracking transmissions, and it's possible they could have mated. We don't necessarily know what the goats are doing out there in the woods, but their signals were very close. Cougars preyed on several goats, according to the progress report. A bear might have gotten another. One likely fell to its death on a steep embankment. Harris suspects others might have starved. Quote, in a naturally stable population, you would expect to see survival of adult females at 85 to 90% and a little lower for males, he said. Still, quote, the survival rate you observed is within the bounds I would have guessed, Harris has said of the survival rate near 70%. We also had a rough February. The weather was squirrely. We did have a month with pretty heavy snow, which can make it difficult for the animals to find food. Park officials plan two rounds of capture this summer. The first began July 8th, and the second will begin August 9th. Several areas of the park will see closures during capture operations. More operations are planned for future summer. Goats who cannot be captured will eventually be shot. Park officials have aims to eradicate the creatures for decades, arguing that mountain goats harm plant life, get too close to visitors, are not native to the peninsula, and wouldn't be there if humans hadn't brought them nearly a century ago. Meanwhile, state wildlife officials and tribes have been keen to move them into the North Cascades, where overhunting decades ago hampered populations. They hope more goats and genetic diversity there could boost populations. This was a news report in the July 3rd, 2019 issue of the Seattle Times. So I kind of looked, had to look on a map here. And the national park they're talking about is sort of the west or northwest of Seattle. And then right to the east of that park is all the Puget Sound and all the water coming to Seattle. And then if you keep going east past Puget Sound, you'll hit the Cascades Range again. And that's the mountains proper that they're moving them to instead of having them being on the peninsula there. So I don't know. What do you think of this, Jeannie?
It's such an invasive, hard on the animals project to do. For this label of non-native species, which we have developed among our environmental community a really strong sense of what is native and what is not native. And I just think overall that discipline needs to take a really hard look at just what their goal is and to bring some compassion into these into the decisions that they're making. Nothing about this sounds compassionate to me.
And obviously
I don't have the research into like why and how this decision was made, what stakeholders played a role, what animal advocates testified to in protesting this kind of project. It just seems complicated, deadly, hard on the animals, and expensive.
Yeah. I mean, I almost feel like it would be better just to shoot the goats, you know, because this is, everybody tends to think with wild animals, they're like, I'll just drop them somewhere else. It's like, well, hold on. You drop me in Montana, I'm probably going to die. You know, like, you're in the, where am I? You know, like, yeah. you don't know where anything is. And I'd also suspect that in this park, it's probably also lacking predators and other animals that they could reintroduce there that they don't want to. But yeah, it's just, it's kind of the wackiness that man will do, I guess, is what's going on here.
Yeah, there are just very few of these types of wildlife management projects that actually succeed.
Yeah.
You know,
even doing it once, if they got 100 goats over there and 70 survived, that's enough genetic variability. You don't need
one would think, right?
One would think. You don't need to do this for years and years and years.
Yeah. And then also, of course, there's the whole issue of, you know, goats who cannot be captured will eventually be shot.
Yeah.
That is where that community, the environmental wildlife management community, that's like a hunter mindset.
Yeah.
As opposed to a let's try something more humane like sterilization by whatever means, non-invasive or, you know, invasive sterilization. It just doesn't seem necessarily like the thing that has to be done.
I guess, like you said, none of this is, there's no compassion in any of that.
Yeah. So, anyway, well, maybe we'll do another story on the condor, which is, you know, touted as a success story. I'm really happy to see those guys reproducing in the wild finally, but at what cost and how much of a flag do we say this is what we need to do?
Right.
As a society, we will not be able to expend that kind of money or effort, and nor will we be able to preserve that habitat for these critters.
I guess we're eating time, but, you know, say go back to the condors. Meanwhile, we're fighting battles on pesticides, which will ultimately kill certain birds like this. You know, so as a society, you know, we're burning money every which way and maybe not always accomplishing much.
All right, Danny. You've been listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM. What is our next news story?
Our next news piece is something fascinating from the journal Nature on how the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is back in vogue again these days, in 1991, led to a large drop in greenhouse gas emissions because the resulting economic crisis meant that many people stopped eating meat. Meat from domestic livestock farming was a main food staple during communist rule in the region. In 1990, Soviet citizens each consumed an average 70 pounds of beef a year, 27% more than Western Europeans and four times more than the global average at the time.
But not more than U.S. consumption, which I looked up, and in 1990, per capita U.S. meat consumption was a whopping 107 kilograms, 236 pounds.
Wow.
that's a lot of animals.
Yeah. But meat demand and livestock production in the region fell drastically when the prices of everyday consumer products soared and the purchasing power of the ruble dwindled in the post-communist economic crisis. An estimated one-third of late Soviet cropland has been abandoned since. These changes in the food and agricultural system in the former Soviet nations resulted in a net reduction of 7.6 billion tons of greenhouse gases in carbon dioxide equivalent from 1992 to 2011, based on data on livestock consumption and international trade. Russia currently emits about 2.5 billion tons of greenhouse gases per year. Glenn Peters, an independent carbon budget specialist at the Center for International Climate Research in Oslo, and not an author of the Nature paper, said there was a large drop in industrial production and emissions after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it's no surprise the same happened with food consumption and production. The study highlights the potential for carbon uptake in the former Soviet Union, but also the risks that carbon will be released if agricultural production returns. Production here of beef meat, I assume. Meat consumption, especially beef, and land use changes in Russia and Central Asia are a widely overlooked factor in calculations of greenhouse gas emissions from land around the globe, says study author Florian Schierhorn at the German Leibniz Institute of Agricultural Development in Transition Economies.
Who knew, right?
Right. Trends in international trade suggest that emissions associated with meat consumption are on the rise again. Russia has, over the past decade, become a top destination for beef exported mainly from South America. And as a side note, that's where they cut down the jungle to raise beef or to raise soybeans to feed the beef. And that was a summary of a peer-reviewed study posted by the journal Nature on July 1st of this year. The full paper was published in Environmental Research Letters in June 2019.
So I just thought this was fascinating, right? This is what they call one of those natural experiments, right? So you cut back your meat production for whatever reason, whether it's a war or because your economy completely collapsed.
Right.
Look at that reduction in greenhouse gases, right? If we could all do that voluntarily without having an economic crisis,
it'd be great.
You know, we could start chipping away at our greenhouse gas emissions. So anyway, and I do think that the one commentator is kind of on the mark about the the threat, the impact on greenhouse gas emissions once Russia gets back into the groove of producing its own meat, or continues to, you know, outsource that industry to South America. All right. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM. Our final story in today's grab bag of news is celebrity news. We usually don't talk about celebrity news too much because vegan celebrities come and they go. But Jaden Smith, the son of Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith, opened up a pop-up vegan food truck on his birthday in L.A. in a bid to feed the homeless. Jaden Smith is proving that he's just as much an activist as he is a musician. In March of this year, Smith bought a water filtration system to Flint, Michigan, and now he's using his resources and platform to give a healthy helping hand to homeless people in Los Angeles. Jaden reportedly purchased a food truck and transformed it into his restaurant called I Love You. The truck provides free vegan meals to those dealing with food insecurity. The first pop-up took place on Jaden's 21st birthday on Skid Row on July 8th as he personally handed out food to those in need. He also plans to open up more locations in order to serve more people. Charitable endeavors like Smith's are desperately needed. LA has a homeless population of approximately 50,000 people, according to the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. And just as a side note, in case you're really hot on Jaden Smith, in 2018, Jaden Smith was the hottest vegan celebrity, according to PETA 2, the youth division of PETA. And also in 2018, Smith teamed up with plant-based company Impossible Foods and Umami Burger, which is a chain in Southern California, to launch the limited edition menu item Jaden's Impossible Trio. So that is our little bit of celebrity news. I promise there won't be too much of that coming up in the future. I just thought it was kind of interesting. I mean, the young man, he's only about 20. Hopefully he'll, you know, mature into a really effective activist.
Yeah, I don't. I'm hesitant on these things. It's a nice thing to do, especially easy when you're born rich. It also doesn't say, okay, there's a lot of press around this. I saw this go out. How many days a week is this truck open?
Right, yeah.
How long is this truck going to be open for?
It's a pop-up, right? It's
a pop-up. It sounds like so far it's happened once.
Right.
You know?
No,
so,
you are spot on.
It'd be great if it was a daily free food thing. That'd be awesome, you know? But somehow I doubt it.
All right. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino.
All right. Are we doing the calendar, Jeannie?
We're just doing one or two things
right,
in
what
the
do you
calendar.
Got?
What I want to point out is the month of August is coming up, and Nevada County is hosting the Vegan Burger Battle. There are about 12 contestant burgers for customers to try at various restaurants in Nevada County. And that will be the whole month, and it will be benefiting Animal Place Farm Sanctuary. And you can find more information on the Nevada County Vegan Burger Battle on their Facebook page. That is all that I have for the calendar. If you have an event to share, send me an email at chicovegan@gmail.com. And as always, we have one last. No, we have to skip the quote because we are short on time, and we have the real issue coming up.
All right.
This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM Chico. And the views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers, its underwriters, or its staff.
We do, however, reflect the opinions of our non-human fellow Earthlings who'd rather not be killed than eaten, farmed, hunted, raced, experimented upon, flown around in helicopters, or otherwise abused.
Our theme music is Ready to Fall by Vegan Activist Rockers Rise Against. Please stay tuned for KZFR's weekly public affairs program, The Real Issue, coming up next from 6 to 7 p.m. Have a great week, and thank you for listening.
This is Danny Toms and Jeannie Trezino signing off. And remember, till next week, be different, be better, be kind.